Hello and welcome to the Sense Making in a Changing World podcast. I'm Maura Gamble. Join me each week in conversation with leading permaculture and ecological educators, thinkers, activists, authors, designers, and practitioners to explore the kind of thinking we need to navigate a positive and regenerative way forward, to myceliate possibilities and share ideas of what a thriving one planet way of life could look like. My guests offer voices of clarity and common sense. To be honest, this particular episode has been really painful to edit. I've been sitting on this conversation for over a year now. Just before I was about to share it with you last year, Dan Palmer passed away, age 47. It's taken me this long to pluck up the courage to revisit our conversation, and now, with love and respect for my dear friend Dan, I release this episode. This week, his film, Reading Landscapes, is also going live, sharing the observational design practices of permaculture founder David Holmgren. I partnered with Dan on this film project, bringing in Permaculture Education Institute as a sponsor. Dan and I shared a love of permaculture and living systems design. I felt we were kind of kindred spirits, and I really valued how deeply and intensely he cared about the world, about humanity, and how he was not only full of ideas, but he got out and made so many happen. Dan Palmer launched PermaBlitz in Melbourne. He co-created a permaculture design, construction, and education business called The Very Edible Garden. And he was an avid permaculture design teacher, teaching permaculture design certificates in many places. He also hosted a podcast, which I joined him on, called Making Permaculture Stronger. And I loved listening to his exploration of permaculture in relation to holistic decision-making and what he described as the living design process. If you want to take a listen, you can still find all of his episodes. I'll link them in the show notes below. Dan and I also volunteered internationally. And as it turns out, we both ended up in the same school in Uganda, Sabina School. And although Dan had a philosophy doctorate and 30 years of formal schooling, I read a comment by one of his closest friends saying Dan apparently said he learnt more of local and global relevance in those 2 weeks, which he was saying about the permaculture design course he did at Melbourne Uni with Bill Mollison, than he had in his entire 30 years of formal schooling. I really miss Dan. I wish he was still with us. Let me begin first by acknowledging that I'm recording this episode from my hand-built solar-powered studio here on beautiful Gubbi Gubbi country. I'm surrounded here by my permaculture gardens and in a permaculture village. The Sense Making a Changing World podcast is a project of the Permaculture Education Institute. We teach permaculture design, teaching and livelihood skills online to people on six continents, who in turn localize and enrich it and find appropriate ways to apply the planet care ethics of earth care, people care and fair share wherever they are. Before we jump in, I'd like to invite you to subscribe to Sense Making a Changing World on your favorite podcast app, and do leave us a 5-star review and a lovely comment, because it really does help the bots to find this podcast. Okay, let's turn to the conversation with Dan Palmer. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today, Dan. It's been a few years coming that we're going to have this chat, so thank you so much for being here. There's so many things that I would love to dive into talking with you about on this Sense Making in a Changing World show, you know, from the work that you've been doing in creating a livelihood with permaculture, from your exploration of holistic decision making and living systems design, and also your work right now with the film with David Holmgren, Reading Landscape. Maybe just as a beginning point, where are you now? What are you working on right at this moment?
So I'm speaking to you from the Bay of Plenty in Aotearoa, New Zealand, about 600 metres from the Ohinimataroa River on a river flat, or an office in a barn on a river flat. And my family and I relocated here from Australia. I'm from New Zealand about 8 months ago, so we're here doing our thing. And what I've mostly been working on this the last few days is I've been learning how to do hot water plumbing and brazing up a shower for a little homestead set up. And in terms of my kind of design process work, What have I? I'm currently editing. I've got a podcast as well, as you know. You've been on it, and I'm editing up a beautiful conversation with a woman named Laura from the States, who's sharing her take on Indigenous ways of reading landscape, which is really fun. Fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So you also had Tyson recently on your show too, I noticed. And
yep.
I think that's, you know, exploring what you're doing with this film, with reading landscape, and the way you're going with this, I think is absolutely fascinating and a huge gift into the world of permaculture and beyond. Maybe do you want to just share a little bit about what the film is and where it came from? We could start there and head our way outwards from that point.
I'm your guest. I'm very happy to be led by you. Yeah, so happy to speak to anything you're interested to explore. So the reading landscape film, where did it come from? I did a permaculture design certificate in 2005. So how long is it even? Is that quite a long time? So let's figure that out for a second. So 16 years, is it? Yeah.
Something like that.
So I've been into permaculture for about 16 years, involved in permaculture, and along the way started doing professional permaculture design consultancy, initially in the Melbourne suburbs, and then did some stuff in India and Africa, and ended up enjoying working with people that owned small parcels of land, you know, like 5 acres or 10 acres or up to 140 or 200 acres at the outside, in and around central Victoria in Australia. And as I was doing that work, there were times when I felt I didn't have the capacity to do the landscape justice in terms of really understanding what it had to share and who it was, in a sense, where it had come from, where it was heading. And by that time, I'd had David Holmgren as a teacher and a mentor, a soft mentor, you know, like not an official thing, but I spent time with him and learned a lot from him, and we were becoming friends and colleagues. And so I would invite him to come in as a, I don't know, a subcontractor or whatever. You know, I'd say to the clients, I highly recommend that that if you're open to it, we bring in David Holmgren, and they would always be like, hell yeah, let's do that. And so David would come in and just as a one-off, and he'd spend up to 7 hours at the outside, but often 4 or 5 hours, walking the landscape, usually with me and the client or clients, and just really without an agenda aside from getting to know the place. And it was almost a spiritual experience. Well, it was certainly a really profound experience for me, just to be in the presence of David reading landscape as a fundamental human capacity that's diminished a lot over the years, the generations, and just seeing the joyfulness and the dynamic nature of it and just what was possible in terms of reading through the surface appearance of a landscape to understand its deep story and where it's come from, where it's going, and what this thing tells you about that thing and all that stuff. And so I was deeply fascinated. And initially my focus was kind of looking to David, but mostly trying to look at the landscape and like, I want to learn what he can do. But over time I became more interested in what he's doing something different to what we're used to doing. What is he actually doing? What's going on here? And so I started to pay attention and make notes, and also to pull out a phone and record. I mean, it was initially to have a backup record for the clients, just, you know, very amateur rough stuff. And then over time I connected with a filmmaker who's now become a really close friend, David Maher. And David was a student of permaculture, really interested, and so, you know, it was kind of like, well, why don't you come along to one of these things? And he did, and we started to accumulate footage. And it wasn't like the idea of the film hadn't happened yet. It just felt like a good thing to do. I mean, I definitely had a strong sense of there's something really magic and profound and important happening here, and it feels wrong just for me and the client to be here. You know, there's something here for a lot of other people. I know they'd be fascinated to witness this and participate and learn from this. So we then got footage of David teaching on a workshop that we run together on advanced permaculture design process when he was teaching on reading landscape. And then it just organically emerged. It's like, actually, you know what, we really should do something with this footage. What would we do? Maybe a film. Oh, okay, let's make a documentary film. And so it just kind of it organically emerged, and then I found myself in the position of helping this film to happen. And I had a few doubts here and there. I was like, what the heck am I doing taking on another project? I don't know anything about filmmaking, et cetera, et cetera. But I've come through that and I'm really enjoying it. And a big part of my role, as it is in a lot of spheres of my life, is really a connector and a space holder. So supporting David Holmgren to connect with a really beautiful, skilled filmmaker, you know, and they're both doing their thing. And I'm just helping kind of keep the conversation flowing. And it's happening. So we're gonna do it. Yeah.
And it, yeah, so when do you reckon it's going to be released, do you think?
Have
you
got this is the question. At the moment, we were anticipating getting the bulk of it done this year and finishing it early 2022, but with COVID restrictions, combined with the fact that our recent funding campaign went better than we could have expected, which has actually increased the scope of the film, so we're excited to be looking at possibilities of road trips to different parts of Australia and even getting Dave, the filmmaker, just for clarity, I'm going to call the filmmaker Dave and David Holmgren, over to New Zealand. So the upshot is we're probably now looking more like mid 2022, and we're not in a big hurry. Like, it'll be done when it's done. We want to make a great job of it. We want to enjoy the process, but that's the ballpark.
Fantastic. Yeah. I wanted to ask you too, just for the listeners, to unpack a little bit around this process of really deeply reading the landscape and what you've noticed David Holmgren doing, and what shifts when you go that deep. Yeah. What shifts in the design process? What shifts in the design thinking? What shifts in the clients, or what actually happens on site from having that depth of listening and reading landscape at the beginning?
Yeah. Oh, it's so fascinating to me. And I still get sort of shivers when I just think about it. One thing that's really important to me, this film is part of a larger project I call Designing for Life, and I'm really interested in this whole idea of becoming human again, becoming alive again, letting life flow through us and really dropping back into being nested within ecologies and communities and all that stuff, and letting beautiful creations flow without getting out of some of the ruts we've gotten ourselves into. But anyway, one thing that I witness when David moves into reading landscape mode is he comes alive. And it's like all of them, or a great deal of them, shows up. And one time we were at somewhere koala spotting with my family in some national park, I can't remember where it was, near Warrnambool, and a bus pulled up, and a local man got out of the bus, an Indigenous guide, we found out, and his job was to scout for a koala or something, probably a koala, because the tourists were about to get out of the bus and they wanted to take the prize shot or whatever. And I just remember so distinctly the way this person moved through the trees. Like, his whole body was moving, and it was just looking in all different directions, and just this ripple of energy was moving through him, compared to the tourists that got out after him, and they were just like this kind of static head. Like, their body was just kind of carrying their head around. The head would move slowly in one direction or another with the camera, but it was just such a difference. And when I see David reading landscape, he's in that form, that category of, it's just so alive and dynamic. And in his case, it's relatively agendaless. Like, he's not oblivious to the fact that the client's wanting to do things, and sometimes the odd design possibility will emerge. But the primary agenda is just getting to know the place and just the joy of learning about this place without wanting to impose any conclusions or you know, answers on it, just asking questions. And so that's the first thing, and I'm really hoping we can convey that sense in the film, that aside from the technicalities and all the you can go and learn about geology and stuff, to me reading landscape is one important pathway just towards coming alive. And so it's things like using all your senses too. Like, it's very tactile. Like, he's touching things, he's rubbing the bark or picking up a stone and sniffing it and tasting things, as well as constantly looking in and up and down and all around. That's the overall feel of it. And then he's also sharing his train of thought, or just, you know, what he's seeing. And so it's like you've got a window into his mind, and just it's constant questions, and then almost delighted to find that a tentative answer is wrong. You know, it's like, oh, this is probably this kind of basalt or this kind of rock material, and then actually, no, I'm wrong, you know, like excited to be wrong and to ask another question and so on. And it's almost like his whole body is, and all his senses are being used as this multidimensional scanning. Mm. I mean, it's wrong to say machine because it's anything but mechanical, but a scanning kind of process. And from that, a really deep sense of the landscape as this dynamic, living, evolving process is emerging.
And this is just such a different approach, isn't it, than the measuring of the landscape.
Yeah, yeah.
And going in first and measuring what elements are there and what, you know. And I wonder if he's spoken much about how he learnt that skill or whether it's something that he's just like that playfulness. It's almost, in a way, it's kind of like a childlike way of being in the landscape too, that
definitely
that open curiosity without an agenda of just being there.
Mm-hmm.
What has he spoken to you about that skill has come from and how people can learn that? Like, how do you maybe unlearn all these other layers of how you get knowledge with an agenda and, you know, certain metrics that you have to be looking for, to unpack all of that and then come back down into this really grounded, observant, almost, would you call it an intuitive way of being in the landscape?
Yeah, also so much to explore there. One thing I thought I'd mention is there's the first time he came out on a project. It was Yandoit Farm in Central Victoria, and it was 7 hours of reading landscape fun. And his partner Sue Dennett got in touch afterwards and said, "What did you do to my David?" Because he'd obviously come back just glowing with exactly what you're talking about, this childish, just this childish life, and he loves this. He loves it so much. And I want to mention another client, a guy called John Carruthers, who we had David come and read a 70-acre property. Afterwards, John talked about his impression of what David was doing, and he said often we can go into a landscape and we've got a set of filters or a set of kind of layers. It's like where's the wind coming from? What's the slope? What's the vegetation? What's the geology, etc. And his experience of what David was doing wasn't seeing it in a whole set of layers that you then bring together. He was seeing it as an integrated thing, you know, as one thing. But in terms of your overall question, it's a bit hard for me now to pull apart what David said and what I've said in all the conversations. But a huge part of it for me is, because I remember initially I'd see it and I'd want to be there, and I'd want to be there fast. You know, I want to be reading landscape like that next week. And I remember bus trips heading out to spend time with David, and I'd be looking out the window and just freaking out, you know, like, oh, you know, I need to know what tree that is, and is that a valley, or what kind of dam is, you know, that's just, and that monkey mind was killing my ability to simply be present to what was in front of me. And that's a huge part of it. And that's been a huge part of it, as I understand it, for David the whole way along. Which, so firstly, it's just accepting that, hey, I am where I am. And if I know that's a tree, and that's about as far as I am right now, that's okay. It's where I am. Just let myself be there. And then I'm like, what kind of tree is that? You know, ask a question. Oh, it's different from that kind of tree. And it's about relaxing into the fact that you're a human and you have these capacities inside of yourself. And you can just sort of let yourself be where you are and let this stuff gradually evolve. Where, as I've mentioned, a huge part of it is being okay with the unknown, which we can sometimes struggle with. You don't need to know the answer. So often landscapes are so complex. There's been, you know, millions of years of processing and geological uplift and people moving stuff all around. There's so much going on. You may not get to any comprehensive answer. Just ask these, be in the questions. And I like the sense of the distinction between, you can move through a landscape and it's almost like you're consuming it. It's like you're sending your mind and your questions out into the landscape. So, you know, like, I'm going to understand you. I'm going to break you down and unpack you and, you know, put you onto my spreadsheet or whatever, as opposed to letting the flow reverse and sort of, rather than going out to get it, just letting it kind of move through you, or letting yourself move through it, you know, and just, and letting so often I find out things about a landscape that just sort of gently reveal themselves to me when I'm in that mindset. They'll never exist. They'll never reveal themselves to me if I'm going in with that kind of command and conquer, or it's almost a colonial kind of, you know, we're going to settle and develop this landscape. So first of all, we're going to map it, that kind of thing. One really interesting thing, you use that word intuitive, which is an interesting one with David, because as he acknowledges, he sometimes calls himself like a hyper-rationalist. His parents were intellectuals, and that's been his world. And he was raised in the suburbs too. You know, he's self-taught. He's just been curious and asking questions for a long time. So it's sort of interesting because on the one hand, he is a visually and a intellectually dominated person. But on the other hand, there's, whether he likes it or not, or would fully acknowledge it or not, it's clear to me there's certainly there is an intuitive part, you know, of him that's coming up and leading him this way or that and feeding into it. But very different to some people are much more intuitively centered, and it would be, you know, almost all about that.
It's almost like he comes so full of all the information that it just has become this sort of like a oneness, you know, like it becomes intuitive once you become so full of this way of feeling into a space and having a confidence, I suppose, of being with the level of knowledge that you have. And like you're saying, if where you are is just identifying a few things, but you're comfortable with that, it becomes like a really natural feeling. My question that I really wanted to ask you then was, with permaculture, though, it is then starting to map and plan and move through that. And one of the things that you work a lot with is design process. So where is it and how is it that you see that the work that you're doing where you kind of make that transition from the reading, what we're talking about, which isn't the mapping and the measuring, into that process where you do start to download onto something and working with that? And what is that and how is that transition? What does that look like to you?
I think it's such an important topic, and it's so important. There's so many kind of false splits. Often it can seem either or, like either it's intuitive or it's rational, or either it's mind or body or whatever. There's all these splits there, and I like to use words like the distinction between getting and thinking. Or so you can get a sense for a place, which is more emotional, more agendaless, more just letting questions emerge and just kind of feeling, sensing, catching a pulse of a place. And then there's thinking or analyzing, which is starting to say, okay, I actually want to identify the pH of the soil, or, you know, map the wind sectors or whatever it is. And it's a both and situation. Like, both of these things are, they're human capacities, and they're so critical and so important. I read an article recently where they made the same distinction using the word scanning. So this idea of just kind of just scanning and more peripheral vision or peripheral sensing and just taking it all in versus honing, you know, where that's when you might start to actually note things down and firm things up as much as appropriate. And it seems to me that the order does matter, that you're going to be a lot better off if you start with scanning or getting or sensing, feeling. You know, you start with that just openness. I know Dave Jackie, I think, he uses the phrase Zen walk, maybe, or got it from somewhere. You're in that mentality first, and then gradually bringing your focus to the fact, well, you know, if we are going to make some someone's already committed to making design decisions, we do want to have some rigor and some structured mapping or whatever of what's here to complement the stuff we've sensed or got. Yeah.
Oh, I really like that. Mm. Yeah, great. So you've developed up a lot of different tools and processes with your exploration of what permaculture means to you and how that then expands into different fields. Do you want to maybe just share a little bit about some of the influences that you've found has opened up your thinking about what permaculture design is, and or just not even necessarily about permaculture, but you know, around holistic design thinking, living design for life, all these terms that you use. And maybe we should sort of also mention in here somewhere too that you do have a PhD in systems thinking, and how has that informed you as well?
Yeah, sure. Fun question. I did get the PhD along the way, and one of the ways in which that is relevant is where I got to. I ended up just being left alone in the dungeon. I called it this little windowless office at the base of the education faculty, and diving into these dusty tomes in the library and all that. But where I got to was realizing that I started looking into psychology and then philosophy and then all different disciplines, that there was just all these false dualisms or splits, that head was split from heart, from hand, subject from object, people from world, all these separations that were really unhealthy, and that we had to, rather than trying to kind of squeeze these separated things back together, we had to sort of dissolve them or relax back into the fact they were never actually separate. And so when I came to get into permaculture and design process, I brought that along with me. And the way I seem to work is I get a felt sense, like the getting or the scanning, of something's missing here, or things are being confused, and I can't actually be clear about it. But then after months or years, I'm able to firm it up and then provide an intellectual rationale for that thing that was originally just a sense. And along the way, one person that chimed in was Alan Savory with Holistic Management, because I realized early on, as I started working as a professional permaculture design consultant, that it's as important to be able to read people as to read place. And I hadn't learned a lot about reading people in any kind of depth. And I actually think in general, it's a kind of a weak spot that permaculture has. There's scope to deepen and enlarge that. And so Alan Savory got me started on that journey with this idea of supporting people to, and yourself, to articulate your values or your quality of life statements. Why, you know, what deep down, why are you really doing this? And people would say to me, well, we just want to do permaculture. I wouldn't accept that anymore. But like, what does that mean for you? How do you think permaculture is going to take you to wherever you want to go? And where is that anyway? And so on. And just really diving into the ecology of another human and understanding who they are and where they've come from, where they're heading, all that sort of stuff. That's been really important, and I've continued to develop that. And then possibly this single there's a close contender, but possibly the single biggest influence has been Christopher Alexander. And I came across his work early in my journey, which was disruptive and difficult for me at first, because he deeply challenged a lot of ideas that not only are in our culture at large, but are also in permaculture. One of the first ones I got into was this idea that in permaculture design, we ask a client for a list of things they want. We get this wish list of elements, and our job is to join or connect or assemble these elements into a whole system. And Alexander made the incredibly relevant, brilliant point that when you look at how a tree or anything alive got to be, it wasn't created by sticking together leaves and roots and branches. It just wasn't that kind of process at all. It was something very different. It was this organic unfolding process where the parts were actually birthed out of the whole. So it's like, did the leaves create the tree, or did the tree create the leaves? You know, these sorts of questions. And so that led me on this big quest to understand what would it mean to honor that, to actually be true to how life works in design process. And that's a story in itself. And then he helped me get clear on the fact that one of these damaging separations is between thinking or designing on the one hand, and then doing or implementing on the other hand. We're often fixated on getting a perfect plan, you know, getting a perfect design, and only then will we do anything. And just how deeply, deeply problematic and flawed that is. Particularly, it's okay when you're building maybe a rocket, or in my case, a solar system, you know, electrical system the last few days, or a shower or something, but when you're working with living systems, it just doesn't work. It's not sufficient. It's not a helpful distinction. So that was Christopher Alexander. And the last one I'll mention, who's come on the scene for me in the last few years, is Carol Sanford, who's a very profound and powerful regenerative practitioner, thinker. And she's taught me a lot about what this word regeneration has the potential to mean. And also moving in my thinking from being a consultant or a facilitator or even a designer to a resource, to someone who supports, helps people, returns people to themselves as a source of their own growth and development. So rather than me being a designer and giving them a design, I'm actually nourishing and holding space for them to become their own designers. And so when I leave, they keep going. And there's a whole lot of other stuff Carol's helped me with as well.
So how does that work for you? Can you describe what that is? So if someone asked you to come and help them design a place, for a long time you've been a design consultant and helping to design different places through veg, very edible gardens, and your work in rural areas too. So that's, you've got this deep experience in doing that, and I wonder whether that's an important place to start, or do you think you can start where you're at now in your thinking?
Mm. Yeah, it's such a good question. So many people ask me this, and I want to say it's a cop out, but it's almost one of those things that I feel is true, but I have yet to really show it's possible. Because to me, starting with the idea of I'm a design consultant, you're going to pay me money, I'm going to come and talk to you a bit, look at your land a bit or a lot, and then I'm going to draw your plan, and that's the product. I'm going to put a price tag on the plan. You're going to buy the plan, that's where we start, and then over time we can move to something else. Whereas I believe it's so possible to start somewhere else, and it's somewhere else so much more useful. Because not just me, but so many of the people I've interviewed and met over the years that have been designing professionally for 5 to 10 years, that's the same problems. It's like, you know, you go back a few years later and the people never implemented the plan you drew because they never understood it. They didn't have any ownership or connection to it, and various other reasons. It just didn't seem that effective. I mean, that's probably the main one. It doesn't actually – well, my colleague Adam Grubb, he puts it beautifully. There's two main problems with the idea of a design or a plan, you know, that this is what you should do. One is that people don't implement it because they don't understand it, they never get around to it or whatever. The second major issue is that they do implement it. And that's an issue because no plan can ever capture the complex reality that will start to emerge as soon as you actually start to live into something and do things, right? So either one is flawed. And so, the way I work these days is I've totally redefined what I see my work as, where my work isn't to give you a plan, to give you any answers. My plan is to come and basically ask you a whole lot of questions and support you to grow your own solutions, you know, and create your own design. So I'm coming in more as like a mentor. I like this word resource or educator. And I'm really clear with people up front about that. And I can make a pretty good case for it because I can get across, I've got lots of case studies behind me now. I didn't have that at the start. But what you're going to end up with is not only so much better, like so much more adapted to who you are and who your place is, there's not like my role is to make myself redundant as soon as possible. So I'm not feeding in any dependency. Like you decide you move property or you want some more. Oh, we need Dan again. I'm gone. You know, I'm just there as a cheerleader once you get up and running. And when you fall off the rails, come back and help you, because for a lot of people what I'm calling living design process is a really it's a fundamentally new experience, you know. And a lot of it is trusting, just like reading landscape, is trusting that they have the potential to be their own designer, you know, to be in charge or to be on the steering wheel of their own journey. And they don't need to outsource their life to external experts, I don't want to buy into that anymore.
I feel into exactly what you're talking about, because I think, you know, the similar experience I had, and that's why I focus on supporting people to become permaculture educators, or, you know, and that be for their own work or for working with others, because I really see this role as permaculture education. It's not necessarily teaching a PDC. You can teach that, but as a permaculture educator, it could be as this role that you've just described then. And it, you know, this one-to-one long-term relationship. And I think this idea of it being, like you're saying, a process rather than a thing, like design is a process, not a thing that you deliver. And I think that distinction that you've just made is so important, absolutely critical in shifting what actually happens. Because I think, you know, one of the things that you're asking people is, you know, how you want to be in your life. And how you relate that to what's going on in the world right now with, you know, species extinction, climate change. When you're talking with people about beyond I want to do permaculture. Is that where you're heading as well? Like there's, where is that sense of being in the world differently in this way relating to what's happening in the world in a bigger picture and this sensing into a new process, way of being in the world?
Totally, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, it is all related for me. And to me, supporting myself and those I'm working with to kind of get grounded in what's actually like an ancestral way of being, an ancestral process that we've just recently fallen out of touch with. A big part of that is cultivating the ability to get more and more deeply in tune with who you are and what it is that you actually value, what's important for you, what you've done. And it's very rare for me to find or work with someone who's already particularly clear on these things. It does happen, but quite often we're not that in touch. We haven't spent that much time asking the question, why do I really want to do this? What really matters to me? And so there's some processes we can use to take that deep, and often it involves tears and hard work and everything. And to me, that can become like the DNA or part of the DNA of a project. And part of what that is doing is instilling a clarity about what really matters and what doesn't matter so much. And that, to me, that is one of the biggest ingredients of resilience or even anti-fragility, is when shit hits the fan, as it is and it will continue, as David Holmgren puts it euphemistically, we live in a time of unprecedented surprise. In those moments when what you thought your future was going to be is falling apart, or, you know, whatever, you have to cancel the 10th workshop in a row, whatever it is, to have that clarity on what really matters here versus what doesn't is just so important in terms of informing good decisions, but also in terms of supporting a healthy attitude and psychological resilience and health, right? Like as we know, that there already is, and there will continue to be just massive amounts of kind of psychological fallout and trauma that's a consequence of not having that clarity, because I thought it was all about retaining my identity as whatever, corporate leader, or having this income or whatever it is, when at the end of it all, if you can do the deep work, it's like, hey, if I'm connected to the ecology I live in, if I'm in good health, if my relationships are healthy, if I've got meaningful work that contributes to my community, whatever it is that makes your heart sing, that a lot of that stuff can continue to happen in a time of scarcity and less and chaos and so on. That's one side of it that makes it all connected to me. And it's like it's kind of a divine experience of being able to tune in with other people and support their internal ecology to grow and evolve and to shift back into this way of being, which is, instead of outsourcing my decision making and when something goes wrong, who's the right expert, to be able to kind of fall towards each other and yourself and have a process that you can lean into and you can trust, and that will emerge will reveal the next step and the next step and the next step, and you cross the river by feeling the stones. And like, to me, it's so powerful to witness people going back in that direction. And like a lot of things often happen is certain players and certain people in a group, if there's multiple adults, will be more intuitive and others are more rational and all that. And to see them dropping into the reality that they all have a place, they can all belong and add value to this process. All these things matter. Yeah.
So you teach and you design. How have you noticed your work as a permaculture educator or as an educator in general around these living design as an educator? So I'm really fascinated about how we share this knowledge with other people, how we share these experiences, how we support other people to step into that space of being educators as well. What's your experience of being an educator, and what do you find is most important when you are in that space of holding space for other people that works really well for you?
Yeah, great question. I love that etymologically, where the word actually comes from, that sense of education is a process of drawing out, like seeing into what's already there and drawing it out, nourishing it to reveal itself and grow, getting away from that model of teaching as dropping knowledge into an empty cavity in someone's skull. And it's something I kind of struggle with, and because what I'm talking about, I've been in situations where someone towards the end of a course will say, hey, Dan, look, the course is almost finished and you haven't given us effectively the dot point list yet. You know, we want a procedure or formula or recipe that we can copy and paste into that part of our PDC notes or whatever it is. Whereas what I'm getting across is we're not talking about that. Like just switching up some superficial aspect of knowledge. We're talking about shifting into a different way of being alive, a different way of being. And as an educator, I'm realizing it's hard to do that on a blog post or a podcast or even in a book. Those can all be useful resources. But the two places I'm finding it most useful is firstly when you can be face to face over time. And if I can go into the experience of working this way I'm part of a small community of others that over years have been collaborating and stopping and sort of debriefing. If someone else can come in and walk alongside us, so much can land that no amount of talking or whatever mm-hmm. writing will convey. So that's really powerful. And the other thing I'm really excited to have discovered, which is through Carol Sanford's influence, is like one of my projects is called Making Permaculture Stronger. And part of that, there's a small community. We call it the Making Permaculture Stronger Developmental Community. There's about six probably core people that have, some of them have been part of it for 2 years, and we meet regularly, and realizing that the stuff I'm talking about, it's a process, you know, like it takes time. And so I'm really excited to be working with smaller groups of people ongoingly to resource my own and their and our, like to deeply question and revisit and regenerate our core understandings about what design is, what creation is, or, you know, all that stuff. Whereas the short workshops and the smaller things are kind of side dishes, if you like. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so is this kind of what you would describe then as a community practice or something?
Huh.
Is that what you would call? Yeah.
Yeah. Both of those examples, that's what they are effectively. Community of the first one where you're actually physically next to each other and you can sort of bring someone beside you and you know, they see the questions you're asking, what you're looking at, just like what I'm doing when I'm walking landscape with David. That's very literally a community practice. And then this other one, which some of these people are in Holland or, you know, they're around the world. It's like it's a community of inquiry, of inquiry and development and then going out and practicing and reporting back and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so from a very pragmatic perspective then, as someone who's made a living through permaculture, what advice would you give to people who are starting out in permaculture, for example, to find a way to pitch what they do? Or, you know, I know this is a really big question, but it's, you know, if we want to encourage more people into the world of permaculture and related fields, we need it to be more than just a hobby. Mm. You know, it needs to be something that we can actually find a way to generate some income doing as well. Where have you seen that changing for you or the people that you work with, or where do you find the best place to give advice in that world? Like, how can I make money doing this, or how can I generate an income or a livelihood, however you want to describe it, but, you know, something that will support that, you know, being in place with a family, connected to land, in a local community, and making it work financially as well.
Mm-hmm. I just had a flashback for a while. People, like that is a common question. And some years back, I developed a workshop through Veritable Gardens called the Veg Green Business Incubator, which was fun. And a lot of that was about just supporting people to ask the right questions and not, really what it comes down to for me is living a living design process with respect to that question, which is rather than saying, that seems to be working for that person, so I'll copy and paste that, or I'll hire some expert to give me blanket advice or whatever, to do the work of actually tuning into what's my DNA, who am I, what's my work, what do I have the unique, Carol calls it essence, what's my essence or what's my uniqueness, what do I have the unique capacity to bring, what brings me alive, and also what is my circumstances, you know, what's my resource base, who's my community, et cetera. And then letting a life emerge from that includes the fact that, we live in an economy and money's good. And so how's that going to factor into the mix? We're part of what I'm then excited to, and it's a difficult long-term thing because I am finding it is a really big shift we're talking about. And it's funny because sometimes it's a shift that can be seemingly invisible at first. Like aren't you just saying what we already do? Nope. Something a bit different. But that alone, once you've experienced it and embedded it, is such a powerful and useful thing to be able to offer others that has real value and that people are happy to pay for, you know, to resource others, to act as an educator to others, to support them in their own decision-making and so on. Yeah. So on the one hand, like I've got the workbook for the Green Business Incubator, which I could even pull up and share if you want, which has a lot of specific stuff like, well, you know, so you want to make a living from permaculture. That's a pretty big and vague direction. Let's get a lot clearer and hone in on, you know, is it designing? Is it education? Is it something else? What kind of blah, 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 which is useful, just getting clear. But then more recently, I'm interested in that bigger conversation of like step back from even the conversation. Well, I need to make a living. I want to make a living to like, well, what's the shape of my life as a whole? And how do I approach all the aspects of my life, my relationships, my passions, my livelihood as a whole unit, you know, and let it emerge, which has been a real journey for me.
Yeah. And so with the whole of you and your family, where are you seeing the interactions with that from this perspective of livelihoods interacting with your community as a whole?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, I mean, part of the whole livelihood equation is the ins and outs, right? So part of the decisions we make have implications for how much it costs to live. Mm-hmm. And so how we are as a family actually affects how much I need to earn to generate a livelihood. And so that's all part of the whole picture. I mean, in my own case, we started a business, in some ways conventional, Veritable Gardens, you know, that had a company structure and built that for years, and that's still going fairly strong. So I'm now in a position as a part owner of an established business to have the luxury of a small but reliable income stream to sort of subsidize the transition. And for me, I'm doing the stuff I'm talking about in my own way. Like, I'm really loving resourcing others in communities, and people are happy to pay a subscription for that. So just kind of inventing new stuff, finding out new things. And in terms of my local community, that's something I'm excited to be heading toward, because we've just relocated from Australia, and I work with people from around the world. And yet we're here located physically in this amazing community with really, really, really prominent Indigenous Māori New Zealand people and language and possibilities and projects and so on. Although that said, I love the idea that I'll choose to engage in a lot of those outside of a strictly financial. There'll be a value exchange, but you know, my kids will be involved, and it'll be a rich learning experience for us as unschoolers, and whatever. There'll be social capital that accumulates, and not having to look at it all through a financial lens.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such a key part of thinking about our livelihoods, that it's not just a monetary exchange. I can't remember how many years I lived on the smell of an oily rag, but yet that's not a very good term, is it? That's a very mechanistic term. But, you know, that's kind of what it was. But yet I felt incredibly rich because of the richness of the relationships in the community and the abundance of resources that were around. And, I think that's this bringing all of that into our thinking is so important. Yeah, I heard you say unschooling, and I wanted to maybe just touch on that a bit and ask how that's going, and in what way is your thinking that you've just been describing influencing how you're doing your unschooling approach?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I should have a clear disclaimer, or be very upfront here, that it's like a complex, challenging journey, and there's nothing best practice or whatever about how we're navigating it. But it's also just delicious and exciting and dynamic. It was in the first lockdown we were in Australia last year, where we couldn't go to school, and we enjoyed it so much we thought, hey, let's try this out, and just been taking it one step at a time. And exploring this distinction between homeschooling, which you effectively create a little school at home, to kind of parting company with the whole concept of school as something separate from life that prepares you for life, and just dropping into life, you know, and living together. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of our big experiments at the moment. One of our daughters actually decided about 2 weeks ago she really wanted to go to school after not for a year. And she went to school for 3 days, and now she's very clear that she's back into unschooling. But a big part of how it's playing out for us is this idea. There's this thing called life, you know, which is the ultimate place to grow and learn and express yourself. And we're in a context now where we've made decisions to shape our life. So we're on land, we're building a house, we're tending to animals and plants and crops and doing all the stuff that, to me, is there's no way that stuff can't be super relevant to the future. Mm-hmm. So for our kids to be feeding the lamb in the morning and doing all the stuff we're doing, it feels really great. And then to me, it still feels like a scary and radical experiment, this idea of trusting that a child will kind of turn out okay, you know, will be all right. Mm-hmm. If you let them have more than a socially conventional amount of autonomy and responsibility, so you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. I mean, you might have to do the dishes or whatever, but you get to choose how you want to spend your day. If you want to read, you can read. If you don't want to read, you don't have to read. If you want to go and make another bamboo bow and arrow or balsa plane or whatever it is, we'll support that. And that's been a step into the unknown for me, and scary at times, like, oh my god, you know, is anything going to happen? And sometimes it's amazing and you feel on top of the world, and other times the doubts come back. But just like at the moment, you know, like seeing my kids just go and pick up the ukulele and learn, like, practice that tune for the 1,000th time, but still they're singing and practicing it, or build the plane, or get involved in the wire stripping I'm doing, you know, just move in and out as a respected member of this community. And we're lucky to, I feel like it would be really hard if you were a nuclear family by yourself on a piece of land, and we're lucky to have a couple of other families there, so there's some diversity of adult activities and things to involve yourself in, and also some lovely communal spaces. Like there's a teepee with a fire where my kids have been sleeping for the last 3 nights, so they can start to have those little adventures. So at the moment I'm feeling like, oh my god, this feels so healthy, you know. Yeah. and I would so much rather see this energy rather than going to school. And a big part of it for me too is we are designing and living our life, and it would feel sad. And by the way, I'm not evangelical about this at all. Like, you know, schools are great. They totally have their place, and who knows, you know, we might change our mind about this. But right now we're designing and building our home, and rather than saying, okay, lunches, school bus, off to school, and then my wife and I do some work on the place, that doesn't happen. The kids are with us. And when we say, let's do some design on the house, particularly one of my kids is like, yes, you know, house design, let's go. They're dragging us forward. And to think they get to participate in the design and creation of our home and have ownership, and they help braise up some of the joins in the shower they're going to have tomorrow, all that stuff, just feels so rich and powerful. And to me, that it is one of those separations, is that, you know, you've got life here, and then you've got this little regimented, formulaic practice environment called a school, which again has its place and works really well for a lot of people, but it seems to be part of my path is exploring alternatives, seeing what they.
I've had lots of similar thoughts and doubts and joys as you. I have two homeschooling at the moment and one at school.
Okay,
who's thinking about coming out of school? It was his choice to go. Mm. And just wondering. So my eldest is 15 now, and okay. I'm seeing her unfolding. Like, some days I don't know what she's doing, and then other days I could just see that she's diving into, like, philosophy, just like all day it's philosophy. And then the next day she's creating a new language. Mm. And then the next day all she does is just music all day. And I've often sort of chatted with her, and I said, would you like me to just check in that you're covering curriculum and make you a bit of a time to, like, this, you know, when the doubts kind of creep in?
She says, yeah.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And she's very clear about
it. I'm good.
But yeah, it's a constant dance, really. And, you know, similarly with you, the reason we have yellow walls on our house is because the kids were involved in designing what the house was to look like, and they wanted bright yellow walls. It was like marigold yellow. Great. Excellent. You know, and it's this beautiful exploration. And sometimes I feel I doubt myself that I'm doing the right thing. And then other times I just sit back and I think, I watch, and seeing them grow through this, you know, we've been doing it for a long time now, and talking to a lot of other parents who've been doing this too, just saying how absolutely incredible it is. So, yeah, it is a journey. And
sure
and,
is.
And I think the thing about designing your life in a way that that is a possibility is one of the most important parts of it, that the space that you're designing in your life holds that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Because that other separation is between work and life, you know, that we commute off. And so we're getting to a point where I have an office like a kilometre down the road that I come and go to, but we're around, you know, we're together. And I wanted to mention too that discovery for me that initially I thought we were unschooling the kids, but realising that we were actually unschooling ourselves as adults, like actually questioning and deconstructing the whole concept of school, which is so deep and related to so many of the that unless you go to school, you're going to be a retard, and you need school, you need order, you need discipline, you need all this stuff, you know.
Socialization is the big one that I hear.
Yeah. We need schools to prepare, you know, competent citizens, and otherwise everything will fall into chaos, which may be true. I don't know, but it's interesting to realize that it's as much about us as the kids. The kids are fine, right?
Yeah.
They're good.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the thing that struck with me was my daughter did decide to go back to school for a while, for about a year, and then decided to step out. She said, look, Mum, I know about what's going on in the world. I know about what's happening with the climate crisis, with the extinction crisis, with all these things that are going on. There's not a single thing that is spoken about at school about any of that. Any of the directions or the work that, you know, people talk about you're heading towards is your career. Mm. Never takes any of that into consideration. It's like I'm this split person. I know all this, and when I'm at home I can be my full self. But when I'm at school, all my assignments, everything I write about, everything I talk about has to be about this these abstract concepts that have no relation to the world I'm in. Mm. And I went, okay, well, you know what, if you think you've had enough of that experiment, you're very welcome to come back home. Mm. And she did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautiful.
And it's I've sort of found that split was one of the biggest challenges. Anyway, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to be in this sort of full sense of family and have them here in and out and being part of the whole community. Because as you know, I live in an eco village. You know, up the road, the musician and the filmmaker down the road, there's different people who pick up different threads of interest and conversation with them, which is just fantastic. It's that, you know, is that whole community sense. Yeah.
Yeah, the village to raise a child thing. Need baby steps.
You know, it sounds like a cliche, and it is when you put that out, but it just feels so true and so nourishing when you kind of step back and allow that to be. So, yeah, I like to step away from cliches, but sometimes they just kind of come out and it kind of feels a little bit like it feels true in this sense. And also, though, that the community is not just the physical community that's around you, like the village, you know, the permaculture village. I mean, Maya's part of creating this, the PermaYouth, and which has people from all around the world participating and dropping in and sharing their ideas. Like David came and joined them, and Charlie, and you know, all these different people are coming and having these conversations with them. And so it's the whole global village of permaculture people that are supporting them as well. And really it's about relationship and connection and building a sense of, I don't know, like these community mentors. Like, and for me that seems to be a really important thing. Like tomorrow we start a new group of young people who are working with Fridtjof Capra and systems thinking. And so it's PermaYouth, systems thinking. And so what are the things that I can offer to young people as a opening up spaces? And I'm really seeing this intergenerational opportunity that's different from schooling, that it's creating spaces where people can step in and have conversations about big ideas together. And that's really nourishing for me and nourishing for them. And I'm loving this idea of, as my homeschoolers unschoolers, whatever they don't like either of those terms, so we haven't quite worked out a word yet. But
yeah.
As my children are growing and their inquiries are expanding, I'm kind of stepping into those spaces with them, and it's absolutely a wonderful space to be in. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. Oh, beautiful. That's so nice. Lovely to hear about your experience there.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I think my eight-year-old's deciding to kind of come and join them soon. I think he's had enough of the other bit, but yep, anyway. Yeah,
too much fun happening at home.
Thank you so much for taking the time today, Dan, to explore your world of thinking and being, and the influences that you've had and ways in which you work and be with your family. I think, you know, all of these different ways of expressing how you've landed your thinking now, and that that's not a fixed thing, that it's a constantly evolving and dynamic process in itself. I think it's such a beautiful thing to hear right now, because there's so much flux and change, and there's so much questioning and possibility for change as well. And I think it's really important to hear stories of how people have negotiated that in their lives. So thank you for being so open and sharing and generous with your experiences and ideas and ways of being.
Thanks, Mike. I just always love engaging with you. Ever since we connected at that thing, that permaculture convergence several years back, it's a real joy to know you and to be able to connect. And you ask fantastic questions. I've never explored the whole unschooling thing at all. You know, our family is fairly private, so that my kids and my wife and, you know, they're not part of the kind of what's on websites and stuff. But it feels lovely to acknowledge that they are part of the whole of my life, and that we're making similar experiments and explorations across it all. Yeah.
Wonderful. All right. Well, take care then, and enjoy the rest of your building of solar systems and hot water systems, getting your world set up there in your new place. All right. Well, take care, and thanks again.
Thanks, Morag. See you soon.
Well, thank you for tuning in to this episode of Sense Making in a Changing World. Check out the show notes below to find links to the resources mentioned in this episode. Also, this is where you'll find details of all of our permaculture courses, our permaculture YouTube blog, and free masterclasses and permaculture film clubs. Make sure you signed up to hear all of the news and updates. And come and join us at the Permaculture Education Institute to learn practical skills for designing and teaching permaculture and making a good livelihood while living a permaculture-inspired one planet way of life. Take care, everyone. See you soon.